Paramahansa, Paramacharya, also Tara, Satashi Shimahad, His Divine Grace of Ayat Charana, the Bhakti Vananda, Gosami Maharshila Prabhupada, Kijai, Iskan Founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada Kijai, Anantakoti, Vaishnava Vrinda Kijai, Namacharya, Srila Haridas Thakur Kijai, Prem Se Gaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda Sidwaita Gadadha, Shivasiddhi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Kijai, Shri Shri Radhakrishna Gopikopanath, Sai Mukunda, Radhakunda, Giri Govardhan Kijai, Vrindavan Kijai, Maturanam Kijai, Chakradasami Kijai, Yamuna Mai Kijai, Shrimati Lassi Devi Kijai, Samaveda Bhakta Vrindi Kijai, Gaur Premananda, Hari Hari Bo. All glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Namah Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Pristaya, Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Samani Chinamani, Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pachari, Nivashesha Shunyavani, Paschacha Deja Tarani. Alrighty, let's read. My dear Lord, please be merciful to me, because who can be more merciful than your lordship within these three worlds, Lord Chaitanya? Your incarnation is just to reclaim the conditioned fallen souls, but I assure you that you will not find a more fallen soul than me. Therefore, my claim is first. My dear Lord Nityananda, you are always joyful in spiritual bliss, since you always appear very happy. I have come to you because I am most unhappy. If you kindly put your glance over me, I may also become happy. My dear Advaita Prabhu, husband of Sita, you are so kind. Please be kind to me. If you were kind to me, naturally, Lord Chaitanya and Nityananda will also be kind to me. I pray for the mercy of Sarup Damodar, the six Goswamis, namely Sri Rupa Goswami, Sri Sanatana Goswami, Sri Bhattu Raghunath Goswami, Sri Gopal Bhatta Goswami, Sri Jiva Goswami, and Sri Raghunath Das Goswami, and Lokanath Prabhu. I, Narottama Das, pray to the merciful Srinivas Acharya, and I always desire the company of Ramachandra. So the Ramachandra he's referring to here is his friend Ramachandra, not Lord Ramachandra. Okay. So now we will proceed with our continued reading of Krishna book. And as I mentioned before, according to the calendar, tomorrow is actually the day of Diwali, Govardhan Puj, Gopuj, and Gokrida here in North Carolina. And probably where you are now, it's either today or tomorrow, but anyway, that you will have to figure out. Okay, let us figure this out. Okay, so Omagana Timidanda Sha Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unminitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of my spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, who so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was blinded in the darkness of ignorance. So continuing with the Krishna book, and we are on chapter 61 today. Let me adjust the volume, make sure we have a little more volume here. That's good. All right. Chapter 61. So, share the screen. And where is that? There it is. Chapter 61 is called The Genealogy of the Family of Krishna. Jai. Genealogy. Ki Jai. All right, here we go. Let's get set up here. Okay, so Krishna had 16,108 wives, which is nothing for Krishna, and in each of them he begot 10 sons, all of them equal to their father in the opulences of strength, beauty, wisdom, fame, wealth, and renunciation, like father, like son. All the 16,108 wives of Krishna were princesses, and when each saw that Krishna was always present in her respective palace and did not leave home, she considered Krishna a hen-pecked husband who was very much attached to her. Every one of them thought that Krishna was her very obedient husband, but actually Krishna had no attraction for any of them. Krishna, yes. Although each thought she was the only wife of Krishna that was very, very dear to Lord Krishna, being Atmarama, self-sufficient, felt neither attraction nor enmity toward any of them. He was equal to all his wives and treated them as a perfect husband would, just to please them. For him, there was no need of even a single wife. In fact, since they were women, the wives could not understand the exalted position of Krishna nor the truths about him. All the princesses who were wives of Krishna were exquisitely beautiful, and each one of them is attracted by Krishna's eyes, which were just like lotus petals, and by his beautiful face, long arms, beautiful ears, pleasing smile, humorous talks, and sweet words. Influenced by these features of Krishna, they all used to dress themselves very attractively, desiring to attract him by their feminine bodily appeal. They exhibited their feminine characteristics by smiling and moving their eyebrows, just thus shooting sharp arrows of conjugal love just to awaken Krishna's lusty desires for them. Still, they could not arouse Krishna's mind or his sexual appetite. This means that Krishna never had any sexual relationships with any of his many wives, save and except to beget children. The queens of Dwarka were so fortunate that they got Lord Krishna as their husband and personal companion, although he is not approachable by exalted demigods like Brahma. Lord Krishna and his queens remained together as husband and wife, and Krishna, as an ideal husband, treated them in such a way that at every moment there was an increase of transcendental bliss in their smiling exchanges, talking and mixing together. Each and every wife had hundreds and thousands of maidservants. Yet when Krishna entered the palaces of his thousands of wives, each one of them used to receive Krishna personally by seating him in a nice chair, worshiping him with all requisite paraphernalia, personally washing his lotus feet, offering him betel nuts, massaging his legs to relieve them of fatigue, fanning him to make him comfortable, offering all kinds of scented sandalwood pulp, oils, and aromatics, putting flower garlands on his neck, dressing his hair, and getting him to lie down on the bed and assisting him in taking his bath. Thus, they served Krishna always in every respect, especially when he was eating. They always engaged in the service of the Lord. Each of Krishna's 16,108 wives had 10 sons. The sons of the first eight queens are listed as follows. By Rukmini, Krishna had the following 10 sons: Pradyumna, Charudeshna, Sudeshna, Charudeha, Sucharu, Charugupta, Bhadracharu, Charuchandra, Vicharu, and Charu. None of them were inferior in their qualities to their divine father, Lord Krishna. The names of Satyabhama's 10 sons are as follows. Well, 10 sons: Banu, Subanu, Swarbanu, Prabanu, Banuman, Chandrabanu, Brihadbanu, Atibanu, Sribanu, and Pratibanu. The 10 sons of the next queen, Jambavati, were headed by Samba. Their names were as follows: Samba, Sumitra, Purijit, Shatajit, sorry, Sahasrajit, Vijay, Chichaketu, Vasuman, Dravida, and Kratu. Lord Krishna was specifically very affectionate to the sons of Jambavati. Ten sons Lord Krishna had by his wife Satya, the daughter of the king Nagnajit, were as follows: Vira, Chandra, Ashvasena, Chitragu, Vegavan, Vrisha, Ama, Shanku, Vasu, and Kunti. Among all them, Kunti was very powerful. Krishna's 10 sons by Kalindi were as follows: Shrutakavi, Vrisha, Vira, Subahu, Bhadra, Shanti, Darsha, Purnamasa, and Somaka, the youngest son. The 10 sons Lord Krishna begot in his next wife, Lakshmana, the daughter of the king of Madras province, were named Pragosha, Gatravan, Singha, Bala, Prabala, Ur, Bhoga, Mahashakti, Sahauja, and Aparajita. The 10 sons of his next wife, Mitravinda, were as follows: Vrikaharsha, Anila, Grida, Vardhana, Unada, Mahumsa, Pavana, Vani, and Kshuti. The 10 sons of his next wife, Bhadra, were named Sangramajit, Ryatsena, Sura, Praharana, Arijit, Sitjaya, Subhadra, Bama, Ayur, and Satyaka. Besides these 8 chief queens, Krishna had 16,100 other wives, and all of them also had 10 sons each. The eldest son of Rukmini, Prajuna, was married with Mayavati from his very birth, and afterwards he married Rukmavati, the daughter of his maternal uncle Rukmi. From Rukmavati, Prajuna had a son named Aniruddha. In this way, Krishna's family, Krishna and his wives, along with their sons and grandsons and even great-grandsons, all combined together to include very nearly 1 billion family members. Oh my God. So, actually, it's a spiritual realm, so Krishna could expand Dwarka like that. Rukmini, the elder brother of Krishna's first wife, Rukmini, was greatly harassed and insulted in his fight with Krishna, but on the request of Rukmini, his life was spared. Since then, Rukmini held a great grudge against Krishna, was always inimical toward him. Nevertheless, his daughter married Krishna's son. And his granddaughter married Krishna's grandson, Aniruddha. This fact appeared a little astonishing to Maharaj Pariksha when he heard it from Shukadeva Goswami. And the king addressed him as follows: I am surprised that Rukmini and Krishna, who were so greatly inimical to one another, could again be united by marital relationships between their descendants. Pariksha Maharaj was curious about the mystery of this incident, and therefore he inquired further from Shukadeva Goswami. Because Shukadeva Goswami was a perfect yogi, nothing was hidden from his power of insight. A perfect yogi like Shukadeva Goswami can see past, present, and future in all details. Therefore, from such yogis or mystics, nothing can be concealed. When Pariksit Maharaj inquired from Shukadeva Goswami, Shukadeva Goswami answered as follows: Prajuna, the eldest son of Krishna born of Rukmini, was Cupid himself. He was so beautiful and attractive that the daughter of Rukmi, namely Rukmavati, could not select any husband other than Prajuna during her Swayamvara. Therefore, in that selection meeting, she garlanded Prajuna in the presence of all the other princes. When there was a fight among the princes, Prajuna came out victorious, and therefore Rukmi was obliged to offer his beautiful daughter to Prajuna. Although enmity always blazed in Rukmi's heart, because of his having been insulted by Krishna's kidnapping of his sister, Rukmini, Rukmi could not resist consenting to the marriage ceremony just to please Rukmini when his daughter selected Prajuna as her husband. And so Prajuna became the son-in-law as well as the nephew of Rukmi. Besides the 10 sons described above, Rukmini had one beautiful daughter with big eyes, and she was married to Kritavarma's son, whose name was Bali. Although Rukmi was a veritable enemy of Krishna, he had great affection for his sister Rukmini and wanted to please her in all respects. On this account, when Rukmini's grandson Aniruddha was to be married, Rukmi offered his granddaughter Rochana to Aniruddha. Such a marriage between immediate cousins is not very much sanctioned by the Vedic culture, but in order to please Rukmini, Rukmi offered his daughter and granddaughter to the son and grandson of Krishna, respectively. In this way, when the negotiation of the marriage of Aniruddha with Rochana was complete, a big marriage party accompanied Aniruddha and started from Dwarka. They traveled until they reached Bhojakata. This is a very interesting story, which Rukmi had colonized after his sister had been kidnapped by Krishna. This marriage party was led by the grandfather, namely Lord Krishna, accompanied by Lord Balaram, and it included Krishna's first wife, Rukmini. His son, Prajuna, Jambavati's son, Samba, and many other relatives and family members. They reached the town of Bhojakata, and the marriage ceremony was peacefully performed. The king of Kalinga was a friend of Rukmi's and gave him the ill advice to play chess with Balaram and thus defeat him in a bet. Among Kshatriya kings, gambling. Hold on a second, I gotta fix something here. My computer. Among Kshatriya kings, gambling on chess was not uncommon. If someone challenged a Kshatriya to play on the chessboard, the Kshatriya could not refuse the challenge. Sri Balaramaji was not a very expert chess player, and this was known to the king of Kalinga. So Rukmini was advised to retaliate against the family members of Krishna by challenging Balaram to play chess. Although not an expert chess player, Sri Balaramaji was very enthusiastic in sporting activities. He accepted Rukmini's challenge and sat down to play. Betting was with gold coins, and Balaram first of all challenged with 100 coins, then 1,000 coins, and 10,000 coins. Each time Balaram lost, and Rukmini was victorious. Sri Balaram's losing the game was an opportunity for the king of Kalinga to criticize Krishna and Balaram. Big mistake. Thus, the king of Kalinga was talking jokingly while purposefully showing his teeth to Balaram. Because Balaram was the loser in the game, he was a little intolerant of the sarcastic, joking words and became somewhat agitated. Rukmi again challenged Balaram and made a bet of 100,000 gold coins. But fortunately, this time, Balaram won. Nonetheless, out of cunningness, Rukmi claimed that Balaram was the loser and that he himself had won. Because of this lie, Balaramaji became most angry with Rukmi. His agitation was so sudden and great that it appeared like a tidal wave in the ocean on a full moon day. Balaram's eyes were naturally reddish, and when he became agitated and angry, his eyes became more reddish. This time he challenged and made a bet of 100 million coins. Again, Balaram was the winner according to the rules of chess. But Rukmi again cunningly claimed that he had won. Rukmi appealed to the princes present, and he especially mentioned the name of the king of Kalinga. During the dispute, there was a voice from the sky, and it announced that for all honest purposes, Balaram was the actual winner of this game, that he was being abused, and that the statement of Rukmi that he had won was absolutely false. In spite of its divine voice, Rukmi insisted that Balaram had lost. And by his persistence, it appeared that he had death upon his head. Falsely puffed up by the ill advice of his friend, he did not give much importance to the oracle, that means the voice from the sky. And he began to criticize Balaramaji. He said, "My dear Balaramaji, you two brothers, coward boys only, may be very expert in tending cows, but how can you be expert in playing chess or shooting arrows on the battlefield? These arts are well known only to the princely order. Hearing this kind of pinching talk by Rukmi and hearing the loud laughter of all the other princes present there, Lord Balaram became as agitated as burning cinders. He immediately took his club in his hand and without further talk struck Rukmi on the head. From that one blow, Rukmi fell down immediately and was dead and gone. Phew. Thus, Rukmi was killed by Balaram on that auspicious occasion of Aniruddha's marriage. These things are not very uncommon in Kshatriya society. Thank God I'm not a member of Kshatriya society. The king of Kalinga, afraid that he would be the next one attacked, fled from the scene. Before he could escape even a few steps, however, Balaramaji immediately captured him, and because the king had always shown his teeth while criticizing Balaram and Krishna, Balaram broke all the king's teeth with his club. The other princes supporting the king of Kalinga and Rukmi were also captured, and Balaram beat them with his club, breaking their hands, their legs and hands. They did not try to retaliate, but thought it wise to run away from the bloody scene. During the strife between Balaram and Rukmi, Lord Krishna did not utter a word, for he knew that if he supported Balaram, Rukmini would be unhappy. And if he said that the killing of Rukmi was unjust, then Balaram would be unhappy. Therefore, Lord Krishna was silent on the death of his grandson's marriage. He did not disturb his affectionate relationship with either Balaram or Rukmini. So there's Krishna, even in a conflict situation. You know, what should I do? who should I support? So he just, okay, let me stay away from this. This is actually Yogamaya. Krishna and Balaram are the same person. We understand that. But they're acting differently in different circumstances. And sometimes they even have disagreements. Such as when Arjuna kidnapped Subhadra and Balaram was completely against it. He wanted Subhadra to marry Duryodhana. After this, the bride and bridegroom were ceremoniously seated on the chariot and they started for Dwarka, accompanied by the bridegroom's party. The bridegroom's party was always protected by Lord Krishna. Hold on a second. The killer of the Manu demon. Thus they left Rukmini's kingdom, Bhojakata, and happily started for Dwarka. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport of the 61st chapter of Krishna, the genealogy of the family of Krishna. Okay, nice story. So we have time to start another chapter. And this is an interesting chapter. It's the meaning of Usha and Aniruddha. There's Aniruddha again. Getting married again. So, the meaning of Aniruddha and Usha, which caused a great fight between Lord Krishna and Lord Shiva, is very mysterious and interesting. Maharaj Pariksit was eager to hear the whole story from Shukadev Goswami, and thus Shukadev narrated it. My dear king, you must have heard the name of King Bali. He was a great devotee who gave away in charity all that he had, namely the whole world, to Lord Vamana, the incarnation of Vishnu as a dwarf Brahmana. King Bali had 100 sons, and the eldest of all them was Banasura. This great hero, Banasura, born of Maharaj Bali, was a great devotee of Lord Shiva and was always ready to render service unto him. Because of his devotion, Banasura achieved a great position in society and he was honored in every respect. Actually, he was very intelligent and liberal also, and his activities are all praiseworthy because he never deviated from his promise and word of honor. He was very truthful and fixed in his vow. In those days, he was ruling over the city of Shonitapura. By the grace of Lord Shiva, Manasura had 1,000 arms, and he became so powerful that even demigods like King Indra were serving him most obediently. Long ago, when Lord Shiva was dancing in a celebrated fashion called the Tandava Nritya, for which he is known as Nataraja, Manasura helped Lord Shiva in his dancing by rhythmically beating drums with his 1,000 hands. Lord Shiva is well known as Ashutosha, which means very easily pleased, also very easily angered. And he is also very affectionate to his devotees. He is a great protector for persons who take shelter of him and is the master of all living entities in this material world. Being pleased with Banasura, he said, "Whatever you desire, you can have from me, for I am very much pleased with you." Banasura replied, "My dear Lord, if you please, You can remain in my city just to protect me from the hands of my enemies." Once upon a time, Banasura came to offer his respects to Lord Shiva by touching the lotus feet of Lord Shiva with his helmet, which was shining like the sun globe. He offered his obeisances unto him. While offering his respectful obeisances, Banasura said, "My dear Lord, anyone who has not fulfilled his ambition will be able to do so by taking shelter of your lotus feet, which are just like the desire tree, from which one can take anything he desires. My dear Lord, you have given me 1,000 arms, but I do not know what to do with them. They are simply a burden. I cannot use them properly in fighting, since I cannot find anyone competent to fight with me except your lordship, the original father of the material world. Sometimes I feel a great tendency to fight with my arms, and I go out to find a suitable warrior. Unfortunately, everyone flees. Knowing my extraordinary power, being baffled at not finding a match, I satisfy the itching of my arms by beating them against the mountains. In this way, I tear many great mountains to pieces." Lord Shiva realized that his benediction had become troublesome for Banasura, and addressed him, "You rascal, you are very eager to fight, but since you have no one to fight with, you are distressed. Although you think that there is no one in the world to oppose you except me, I say that you will eventually find such a competent person. At that time, your days will come to an end, and your flag of victory will no longer fly. Then you will see your false prestige smashed to pieces. After hearing Lord Shiva's statement, Banasura, who was very much puffed up with his power, became elated that he would meet someone able to smash him to pieces. Banasura then returned home with great pleasure, and he was always waiting for the day when the suitable fighter would come to cut down his strength. He was such a foolish demon. It appears that foolish, demoniac human beings, when unnecessarily overpowered by material opulences, or with material opulences, want to exhibit these opulences, and such foolish people feel satisfaction when these opulences are exhausted. The idea is that they do not know how to expend their energy for the right causes. Whoops. Being unaware of the benefit of Krishna consciousness. Actually, there are two classes of men. One is Krishna conscious, the other is non-Krishna conscious. The non-Krishna conscious men are generally devoted to the demigods, whereas the Krishna conscious men are devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna conscious persons utilize everything for the service of the Lord. The non-Krishna conscious persons utilize everything for sense gratification. And Banasura is a perfect example of such a person. For his own satisfaction, he was eager, very eager, to utilize his extraordinary power to fight. Not finding any combatant, he struck his powerful arms against the mountains, breaking them to pieces. In contrast to this, Arjuna also possessed extraordinary powers for fighting, but he utilized them only for Krishna. Banasura had a very beautiful daughter whose name was Usha. When she had attained the age of marriage and was sleeping amongst her many girlfriends, she dreamt one night that Aniruddha was by her side and that she was enjoying a conjugal relationship with him, although she had never actually seen him or heard of him before. She awoke from her dream, exclaiming very loudly, "My dear beloved, where are you?" Being exposed to her friends in this way, she became a little bit ashamed. One of Usha's girlfriends was Chitraleka, who was the daughter of Banasura's prime minister. Chitraleka and Usha were intimate friends, and out of great curiosity, Chitraleka asked, "My dear princess, as of yet you are not married to any young boy, nor have you seen any boys until now." So she was so protected. So actually the men who were guarding her were eunuchs. "So I'm surprised that you are exclaiming like this. Who are you searching after? Who is your suitable match?" On hearing Chitraleka's inquiries, Usha replied, "My dear friend, in my dream I saw a nice young man who is very, very beautiful. His complexion is swarthy, his eyes are just like lotus petals, and he is dressed in yellow garments. His arms are very long, and his general bodily features are so pleasing that any young girl would be attracted. I feel much pride in saying that this beautiful young man was kissing me, and I was very much enjoying the nectar of his kissing. But I am sorry to inform you that just after this, he disappeared, and I have been thrown into the whirlpool of disappointment. My dear friend, I am very anxious to find this wonderful young man, the desired lord of my heart." After hearing Usha's words, Chitraleka immediately replied, "I can understand your bereavement, and I assure you that if this boy is within these three worlds, the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems, I must find him for your satisfaction. If you can identify him from your dream, I shall bring you peace of mind. Now let me draw some pictures for you to inspect. And as soon as you find the picture of your desired husband, let me know. It doesn't matter where he is. I know the art of bringing him here. So as soon as you identify him, I shall immediately arrange for it." Chitraleka, while talking, began to draw many pictures of the demigods inhabiting the higher planetary systems, then pictures of the Gandharvas, Siddhas, Charanas, Panagas, Daichas, Vijayadharas, and Yakshas, as well as many pictures of human beings. The statements of Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vedic literatures prove definitely that on each and every planet there are living entities of different varieties. Therefore, it is foolish to assert there are no living entities but those on this earth. Chitraleka drew many pictures. Among the human beings she drew were members of the Vishnu dynasty, including Vasudeva, the father of Krishna, Shurasena, the grandfather of Krishna, Sri Balaramaji, Lord Krishna, and many others. When Usha saw the picture of Prajuna, she became a little bashful. But when she saw the picture of Aniruddha, she became so bashful that she immediately lowered her head and smiled, having found the man she was seeking. She identified the picture to Chitraleka as that of the man who had stolen her heart. Chitraleka was a great mystic yogini, and as soon as Usha identified the picture, Chitraleka could immediately understand that it was of Aniruddha, the grandson of Krishna, although neither she nor Usha had previously known his name or ever seen him. That very night, she traveled in outer space, and within a very short time reached the city of Dwarka, which was well protected by Lord Krishna. She entered the palace and found Aniruddha sleeping in his bedroom on a very opulent bed. Chitraleka, by her mystic power, immediately brought Aniruddha in that sleeping condition to the city of Shambhitapura so that Usha might see her desired husband. Usha immediately bloomed in happiness and began to enjoy the company of Aniruddha with great satisfaction. The palace in which Usha and Chitraleka lived was so well fortified that it was impossible for any male to either enter or see inside. Usha and Aniruddha lived together in the palace, and day after day, Usha's love for Aniruddha grew 4 times upon 4, 16 times. Usha pleased Aniruddha with valuable garments, flowers, garlands, scents, and incense. By his bedside sitting place were other paraphernalia for residential purposes, nice drinks such as milk and sherbet, and nice eatables which could be chewed or swallowed. Above all, she pleased them with sweet words and very obliging service. Usha worshipped Aniruddha as if he were the supreme personality of Godhead. By her excellent service, Usha made Aniruddha forget all other things and was able to draw his attention and love to her without deviation. In such an atmosphere of love and service, Aniruddha practically forgot himself and could not recall how many days he had been away from his real home. In due course of time, Usha exhibited some bodily symptoms by which it could be understood that she was having intercourse with a male friend. The symptoms were so prominent that her actions could no longer be concealed from anyone. Usha was always cheerful in the association of Aniruddha, and she did not know the bounds of her satisfaction. The housekeeper and the guards of the palace could guess very easily that she was having relations with a male friend, and without waiting for further developments, all of them informed their master, Banasura. In the Vedic culture, an unmarried girl having association with a male is the greatest disgrace to the family. So the caretakers cautiously informed their master that Usha was showing symptoms indicating a disgraceful association. The servants informed their master that they were not at all neglectful in guarding the house, being alert day and night against any young man who might enter. They were so careful that a male could not even see what was going on there. And so they were surprised that she had become contaminated. Since they could not trace out the reason for it, they submitted the whole situation before their master. Banasura was shocked to understand that his daughter Usha was no longer a virgin maiden. This weighed heavily on his heart, and without delay he rushed toward the palace where Usha was living. There he saw that Usha and Aniruddha were sitting together and talking. They looked very beautiful together. Aniruddha being the son of Prajuna, who was Cupid himself, Banasura saw his daughter and Aniruddha as a suitable match, yet for family prestige, he did not like the combination at all. Banasura could not understand who the boy actually was. He appreciated the fact that Usha could not have selected anyone in the three worlds more beautiful. Aniruddha's complexion was brilliant and swarthy. He was dressed in yellow garments and had eyes like lotus petals. His arms were very long, and he had nice, curling, bluish hair. The glaring rays of his glittering earrings and the beautiful smile on his lips were certainly captivating. Still, Banasura was very angry. When Banasura saw him, Aniruddha was engaged in playing with Usha. Aniruddha was nicely dressed, and Usha had garlanded him with various beautiful flowers. The reddish kumkum powder put on the breasts of women was spotted here and there on the garland, indicating that Usha had embraced him. Banasura was struck with wonder that even in his presence, Aniruddha was peacefully sitting in front of Usha. Aniruddha knew, however, that his would-be father-in-law was not at all pleased and that he was gathering many soldiers in the palace to attack him. Thus, not finding any other weapon, Aniruddha took hold of a big iron rod and stood before Banisura and his soldiers. He firmly took a posture indicating that if attacked, he would strike all the soldiers down to the ground with the iron rod. Banisura and his company of soldiers saw that the boy was standing before them just like the superintendent of death with his invincible rod. Now, under the order of Banisura, the soldiers from all sides attempted to capture and arrest him. When they dared to come before him, Aniruddha struck them with the rod, breaking their heads, legs, arms, and thighs, and one after another they fell to the ground. He killed them just as the leader of a pack of boars kills barking dogs, one after another. In this way, Aniruddha was able to escape the palace. Banisura knew various arts of fighting, and by the grace of Lord Shiva, he knew how to arrest his enemy by the use of the Naga Pasha, that means a snake rope or snake loose. And thus he seized Aniruddha as he came out of the palace. When Usha received news that her father had arrested Aniruddha, she was overwhelmed with grief and confusion. Tears glided down from her eyes, and being unable to check, herself, she began to cry very loudly. So thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport of the 62nd chapter of Krishna, the meeting of Usha and Aniruddha. And I think we'll wait till tomorrow, hopefully, to finish this. So we did 61 and 62 today. And so this is very interesting. You may ask, why is this story being told? Is ostensibly a very romantic story, and but these are Krishna's family members. Aniruddha is Krishna's great son, and we're going to hear how Krishna defends his grandson and fights with Banasura tomorrow, and also we're going to hear about Krishna's superlative position in relationship to the demigods, especially the relationship to Lord Shiva, and how Krishna's weapons are able to defeat the weapons, especially the Narayana Dwara, is able to defeat the weapons of Lord Shiva. So there's a lot of philosophy and Siddhanta. Siddhanta means everyone's position, tattva, etc., that's being taught in these two chapters through the use of story. And so that's a nice thing. You read these stories, you hear these stories, and it's easier to remember the philosophy for most of us in Kali Yuga when the philosophy is actually portrayed in terms of different pastimes. Of course, the pastimes actually occurred, but it's important to understand the philosophy that's integrated within the description of the pastimes. Okay, on that happy, happy note, tomorrow hopefully we can do chapter 63. 63 is Krishna fighting with Banasura. So, stop the sharing and then allow you all to ask questions so you have an extra 2 or 3 minutes to ask questions today. So, who has a question? You can type in the chat window or you can raise your hand, or if you're bold enough, you can unmute yourself without raising your hand. So, who has a question? Now's your opportunity. Does anybody have a question? Actually, no one has a question.
Please accept my basement, Srila Gurudev.
Oh, Gopal. Okay.
So, Srila Prabhupada says in this chapter that Chitraleka entered the palace that was well protected by Lord Krishna, and practically in the same sentence.
Yeah.
And then just a couple sentences later, he says, Chitraleka brought Aniruddha into Usha's palace, which was impossible to penetrate. So who is this Chitraleka that's so skilled that she's able to penetrate Krishna's defenses?
She could fly through the air. Obviously, she had the ability to make herself invisible, too.
Mm.
This is one of the mystic arts. You can make yourself invisible. You control the minds of others. I mean, you read about the different siddhas. You know, one of them is controlling the minds of the others, and floating in the air, making herself very small. So she had, yes, she was able to disguise herself and disguise Aniruddha and penetrate impenetrable palaces. And also as far as being able to go in and out of the palace in which she was living in, Banasura's palace, she did it anyway. I mean, because she was the daughter of Banasura's minister, so she had the right to go in and out of that palace. But somehow or other, she was able to transport Aniruddha.
You know? And then also...
Because it was Krishna's desire. You know, it's not that Krishna was unaware of this. It happened without his being aware. He wanted it to happen. So he can act as pastime of fighting with Lord Shiva and having his weapons fight with Lord Shiva's weapons to have a good time. Krishna likes to fight with his devotees and Lord Shiva's Vaishnavadam, Yata Shambhu. Lord Shiva is considered the best devotee of Krishna. So Krishna had a good time. It's chivalry. Mm. It's chivalry. You know, he has a good time fighting. And also, they're all enjoying. I mean, Aniruddha is also enjoying the fight, too. So it's. And Usha is an anxiety about Aniruddha. So it also shows that the Lord and his immediate family are actually can be a little romantic. And how we get the romanticism in this material world is because it's a reflection of the Lord's romanticism. Mm. And heroism. And, you know, strength. Krishna's called Vira. Vira means he's very heroic or very strong. Krishna enjoys showing off his strength, showing off his heroism. And there's no false ego. False ego means to think that you're something that you're not. That's false. But Krishna knows he's God and he is God. But we're thinking we're God, but we ain't God. We're thinking, Ishwaroham, Aham Bhogi, Siddhoham, Bhagavan Sukhi. I am perfect. I am powerful. I am happy. You know, everyone should worship me. I am Guru Maharaj. And so then Krishna just shows us, you know, you're not. You are not Ishwara of anything. You're not even Ishwara of your own body or mind. So, okay?
Thank you, Gurudev.
Okay, I believe Shama Priya has her hand up. You have a question?
Krishna Gurudev. Yes, Gurudev. Please accept my humble obeisances. I was just wondering, Banasura had the 1,000 hands and he played for Lord Shiva. I was wondering, was there a special occasion why he played for Lord Shiva for his dancing? Was there any event or?
It doesn't seem to be a special occasion. Lord Shiva likes to dance and chant.
Anyhow,
you know, it's not. Of course, generally, the Tandava Nritya, which is being described there, is the dance at the time of the cosmic dissolution. But there's not an there's not an indication that's the only time that he does that dance.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you know, he may do that dance at other times. And, you know, he has all sorts of dances. He's called Nataraj.
Yes.
Also, Krishna, that's also a name of Krishna. Krishna is called Nataraj, too. It means the king of dance. Even Lord Shiva is called Nataraj. And sometimes that name is given to professional dancers too. You know, a special dance instructor, you know, like one of the best, he's called Nataraj, which means the king of the dancers. Or someone wins a Indian Olympics, I guess they're called Nataraj. Dance performance, okay?
Thank you, Gurudev.
Okay, who's next?
Haribol.
Does anyone else have a question?
Hare Krishna Gurudev, please accept my humble obeisances. All goes to Srila Prabhupada.
All goes to Prabhupada. You have a question?
Yes, I have a question, Gurudev. Now, in this chapter, please correct me if I'm wrong, you know, like It states that Pradyumna married Rukmi's daughter, right?
Yeah.
So in that way, if my understanding is like they are the cousins.
Yes.
So how come in Vedic culture the marriage between
it wasn't Prabhupada specifically? Prabhupada specifically says in the Krishna book that it's not generally not allowed or it's frowned upon.
Yes.
So they did it, you know, because they're of a different category than ordinary human beings.
Right. You know,
it's just, okay. It's generally it's not allowed, especially the reason it's not allowed is because there's birth defects. I mean, just to be practical, when there's not sufficient variety in the genes, and then you get, I mean, scientifically speaking, there's this thing called recessive and dominant genes. I don't know if anyone knows about that, but anyway. And recessive genes means you won't get a particular birth defect, but if someone else has that same recessive gene and it matches up with your gene, which happens very often when there's intra-marriage within a family, then you get birth defects.
Okay.
I remember when I was touring the United States, we go through certain towns where a very small amount of people lived, and they married generally generation after generation, not within the same family, but they married people from the village, and there were a lot of birth defects in that particular village. I remember I was shocked, as like a third of the children or something like that had some sort of deformities. So it's not permitted, but in this particular case, Krishna allowed it somehow or other, or it was his pastime or plan.
Pastime.
Just to drive Rukmi crazy. Yes, enough to drive Rukmi crazy that not only did your sister marry Krishna, but her son married your daughter, and not only that, the grandson of her son married your granddaughter.
Okay.
So, it's really upsetting. It's really upsetting. So, anyway, it's not recommended. Or it's not allowed, actually.
Yep.
But, sometimes in royal families, even in Europe, they would do that. And that's why, remember, there were actually birth defects in royal families in Europe, because they would marry close cousins like that.
Oh, yeah.
So somehow or other, anyway, don't think of it. Of course, you're married already. But anyway, but think that somehow or other, it shouldn't be done.
Okay.
It's prohibited. It's prohibited. But, somehow or other, Krishna's God. He can have 16,108 wives, and so his wives and children can do anything they want. Your guy, you don't have to worry about genes, because you got all your genes are good. You don't have any birth defects. Okay.
Thank you, Gurudev.
Okay, thank you. So, anybody else have a question? You got 2 more minutes before we have to go. Oh,
Rishikesh,
you have a question. Okay.
Hare Krishna, Gurudev. I had a question whether this generation is still continuing today. I heard a rumor that in Dwarka, the same generations of Krishna's family is still continuing.
Well, there was this whole fight that the residents of Dwarka basically killed each other. At least
all
most
of them?
No, most of them. The ones that were demigods. Uh-huh. Had to go back to the heavenly planets. So, that's a good question, which I cannot answer.
But some community from Dwarka, they claim to be, coming from Krishna. They're called Varshaniya. Even their last name is Varshaniya.
Varshaniya, yeah. So I've heard about that. I'm not sure. I mean, sometimes you have these descent. People say they're descendants from Lord Nityananda. But if you really look into the history, Lord Nityananda had two children. That is true, by Vasudha, one of his wives. But the descendants of those children generally tended to be, were, according to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, were disciplic descendants instead of genetic descendants. Isn't it?
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, people may claim that, you know, sometimes we find some members of the Jewish religion who are claiming they're descendants of the Yadu dynasty. You know, Judu, Yadu, you know, similar word. I don't know. That's actually an interesting point. It would have to be researched. And could be. Could be. But that doesn't give them any special prerogative. Just like Krishna had that son, Bhaumasura, and Bhaumasura became a demon. So just because someone may be Krishna's descendant, or even is Krishna's descendant, it doesn't indicate anything that they're special. You know, as much as we'd like to think, you know, they are special, but it doesn't really indicate that at all, because they could become demons. Krishna's sons could become demons, as Bhaumasura did. Okay, good question. So, yes, maybe you should go and do some genetic research if you find the Krishna gene within some of those people. Find one of the genes with a flute or something like that, one of the DNA or RNA codons that actually code for flutes. Anyway, so that's a joke. So, hopefully we'll see everybody tomorrow evening. Thank you very much. All glories to His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. All right.